and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. Except, of course, like this time where I did finish the book weeks ago and just haven't got around to doing the review for various different reasons. You know, I've been travelling a bit, and as soon as I stop travelling, I get home. And then, whenever I get home after my travels, my life pretty much just stops. I was away for, what, 8 weeks or something on this trip? And I've been back for a week and a half now, and it's been really nice, relaxing at home, going out, doing lots of different things. Just didn't really get around to this podcast, and then just forgot about it. Well, not about the podcast, but I forgot that I hadn't reviewed The City and the Stars by Arthur C. Clarke, which I finished a while ago. But I thought I'd get onto it now. A little bit of, not so much news, a little bit of feedback, though. I actually have got quite a bit of feedback over the last few weeks. I've replied to quite a few emails. But if you've emailed me and I've not replied to it, there's probably, I can see like 7 or 8 emails here that I've not replied to yet. The idea was that I was going to reply to you or some of these things in some of the episodes here. But then for some reason, I like I say, didn't get around to doing this. So I will get to all of your emails that you've sent me. Some people are asking different things, but I thought I'd hit one or two of these emails now, mainly about the Starship Troopers review. There's lots of people enjoyed that review as well, and people said, let me put it this way. There was one or two people asked, what do you mean that, Heinlein and Ayn Rand at opposite ends of the political spectrum? That isn't actually what I meant. The specifically what I meant is that they're at opposite ends of writing about political ideals and things like that. You know, if you're gonna, like I say, if you're gonna start off talking about politics and things and ethics and morality and all that different kind of stuff, as they both do, it's best to start off with orbital drops and space battles and stuff like that. You don't have to do it, but I'm just saying that, where, you know, short books written for kids, compared to, which are like at a few hundred pages long, you know, the juvenile novels of Heinlein compared to Atlas Shrugged. I'm just saying, opposite ends of that kind of spectrum. There was quite a few other things that I liked as well. One person wrote an email saying that it really wasn't a fascist society as portrayed in Starship Troopers, which, to be honest, I do agree with in some ways, which is good. I'll actually reply to the email in properly, though. Another thing that I just want to talk a little bit more about here, because I think this does fit in quite well to the review that I'm going to do today of The City and the Stars, but I'm not going to connect the two. I'll just let you connect the two once I get to the end of the review, I guess. It says, this is from Matthew Rasnake, who I actually did reply to about this, but I thought this would be a good thing to talk about now in the podcast. He said, because I mentioned in the podcast review that Rico is a little bit dim in some ways. He never is quite sure what he's doing, and, you know, and he's even told that he's a bit dim and he struggles with his work and stuff like that. But Matthew Rasnake, he said, I'm sure you'll probably get comments from other ex-military people on this review, but I thought I should go ahead and address what seems to be a subtle misunderstanding of military culture that you displayed. And then he goes on to talk about, well, she says, the protagonist changing loyalties, specifically in regards to military unit or platoon, it's bad to use that as an example of his dim-wittedness. In reality, the shifting unit loyalty is a common cultural aspect of military training, at least in the United States Army. A major component of military training is stripping away of individuality and personal identity. You become a number, possibly a last name and a rank, and that's about it. You become a soldier, not an individual. And part of the reason for this is to make a soldier indistinguishable, even by himself, from his unit. And he's necessarily tying his identity up with the trappings and identifying characteristics of his unit or platoon or squad. And I mentioned this in the review that, you know, Rico, he goes from one, he's like, yeah, you know, blockards, blagoons forever, yeah. And then he goes into a different unit and he's now, hey, now the Peter's Panthers forever. And he just, you know, he just goes from one to the other. Now, I, in a way, that I was talking about that as dim-wittedness, but, you know, Matthew here says it's not dim-wittedness, it's actually trained into you. However, this is one of the key points as well. He says, from your self-description, you've gone from evangelistic Christianity to evangelistic atheism and juggling. Perhaps your identity wasn't quite as tied to those interests as some people get, but it seems to be the same general principle. He's saying that, you know, changing your identity and going from one identity to the other isn't a sign of dim-wittedness, you know, even, and it's not really even just a sign of people in the military, because Rico was like that before he joined the militaries, military itself. And yes, people do change and things like that. But my point about the dim-wittedness isn't that he changes his loyalties or changes his interests even before he goes into the military. He's like, yeah, I want to be doing this. I want to be a pilot. I want to do this. I want to do that. I want to do this. And then he goes, well, you're going to be in the mobile infantry. And he goes, oh, I hate the mobile infantry. That's the worst thing to be in. And then within about, a few months of being in the mobile infantry, he's like, yeah, this is the best thing ever, this is great, like that. And it seems to be presented with no sense of irony on the part of Rico himself, but I think quite a bit of irony on the part of Heinlein, who, the writer there as well. He realizes what he's doing there. He's showing the contradiction from one character of Rico to the next part of the character of Rico, and that Rico doesn't understand that he's actually changing as a person, going from one thing to the other. Now, personally, I don't describe myself as an evangelistic atheist. I am an atheist, and I talk about, my own spiritual journey and stuff like that, mainly because I talk about quite a lot about myself, and that's just part of it. I don't consider myself evangelistically atheist at all, though. But the point is that when I was Christian, I thought I was, I was going to be a Christian for the rest of my life. I thought I was going to go to heaven at the end of it and stuff like that. But then as I started changing, I realized that change was going to be a big part of my life. Of course, if you change your faith in such a way that I did, you realize that, hey, this might happen again in the future. I might change back. I might change in a different way. And in this email I sent back to Matthew, I talked, I remember I have a tattoo. And I actually have two tattoos. And the tattoos that I have are things that don't mean anything to me. One is a small bat and one is a small lizard. And when I wanted a tattoo, I actually just wanted a tattoo. But this is back like 10 years ago now. Well, yeah, so it would have been 2000 or 2001. It was 2001 that I got a tattoo for the first time. And at the time, I thought, well, if I want a tattoo, but I don't want to get a tattoo which means anything to me at the moment. I don't want a symbol or a word or anything like that. For example, my sister has a tattoo of a cross and a dove. It's two very religious, very Christian symbols there tattooed on her back. Now, I mean, she's still a Christian, but it'd be a bit weird for me. At the time, I was, realizing that I wasn't so much of a Christian anymore, and that those things didn't mean as much to me as they did 5 years beforehand. So it was a bit strange. I was like, well, what does mean a lot to me? Of course, I was getting into juggling, I was liking music, and I still do like music and juggling. But at the time, I was just like, well, I might change in the future. There's no reason why this thing that is my identity now is going to be anything different. I could put a name on there or a picture or something. So what I did is I chose something which didn't mean anything to me. A bat isn't even my favorite animal. It's not something I have any affinity to or anything like that. It was just a cool little design that I made, and I thought, oh, that's a cool little design, I'll get that tattooed on me. What the tattoo actually meant to me at the time was, this tattoo means that I'm going to keep changing in the future, and that my interests and my passions and things that hold my interest now are going to change in the future. Even to the point of religion's changing, personal philosophy's changing, and stuff like that. And they have over 10 years. And now I know that I'm a different person than I was 5 months ago. Different things. I've changed my mind about things. I've got different interests than I had a year ago. And all these different kind of things going on in my life. And the tattoo is a permanent tattoo to permanently remind myself that I'm going to be changing in the future. And even if in the future I do decide that I don't want to change anymore and I think I am going to stay the same forever in some kind of robotic fashion, pre-programmed fashion or something like that, the tattoo can then just be a bat. It doesn't even have to mean the same thing. So even the meaning of the tattoo itself can change if I think it is going to change and I want to change the past in some way and think about that. So it's just a weird thing. So it's not the dim-wittedness. I don't think changing identity or changing loyalty between units or changing, not wanting to be in the Air Force or in the mobile infantry and then going into the mobile infantry and all these different kinds of things that are going on there, that isn't the thing that makes you dim-witted. It's not the change that's going on with dim-witted. It's not admitting to yourself or not even realizing that as a human being you do change from month to month and year to year and from, life segment to life segment and things like that. So I think that's just a quick little thing to talk about, which again will sort of tie up with this review, which I'll get straight into now. There's 10 minutes talking about feedback, but hey, people said they like it when I talk about, bringing my own personal experiences and philosophies into this. Now, anyway, I had some notes here. Let me see if I can find the notes. Here we go. So, The City and the Stars was, actually, let me look at goodreads.com and I can find it. It was written in, it's here, 1956 by Arthur C. Clarke. It's 256 pages long, which works out around about a 9-hour long audiobook, which I listened to. I have read this book before, and I remembered, hey, this is a pretty good book. I want to read it again. Also, I had listened to the Space Dogs podcast, and the Space Dogs is a podcast is from the Oral. The Science Fiction Oral History Association or something like that, and they're putting out different recordings that they have which haven't been released online and haven't been available for years. And there was this one feature, I think it was like a 45-minute radio feature about Arthur C. Clarke, about what he was writing at the time, but also they got like this roundtable discussion with Arthur C. Clarke and lots of other sort of golden age science fiction writers. I think this was from the 1970s and 1980s, and they're all talking about, you know, Arthur C. Clarke and stuff like that. So I thought, hey, I'm just going to get one of his books and read it. And I've read, I think, all of his novel length fiction, and that's one of the reasons why I've not bothered to, or I haven't got round to actually reviewing any Arthur C. Clarke on this podcast before, mainly because, you know, I've read all of his fiction and sometimes I don't want to read, you know, sometimes I want to read new stuff, sometimes I don't mind reading old stuff. But I thought, hey, I'll give a go with City in the Stars, because I remember it as one of my favourite Arthur C. Clarke novels. Or maybe, I'm not sure if it's my favourite, but, you know, it was a good one. It's one of the science fiction masterworks titles from Gollancz. So, yeah, pretty good, classic book. So, someone else emailed me and they said, why don't you do like the back of the book kind of summing up of the novel before you get into the setting and getting into the technology and the world behind it as well. So, here we go. City in the Stars is a science fiction novel by Arthur C. Clarke. It's a complete rewrite of his earlier novel, Against the Fall of Night. Men had built cities before, but never a city, such a city as Diaspar. For millennia, its protective dome shut out the creeping decay and danger of the world outside. He goes, blah, 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 blah. It takes one man, a unique, to break through Diaspar's shifting inertia, to smash legend and discover the true nature of the invaders. Blum, bum, 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 bum. Like that. So that's what the story is about. It's one guy leaving a city which is there, which is like the last city there. So this is the world, really. It brings it straight onto here as well. Diaspar is a city surrounded by desert, and this is a billion years in the future, a billion years from now, and the whole world has degenerated into this large desert and stuff like that. And also, humanity has been driven from the stars by these invaders that they just mentioned there, and now all of humanity lives in a single city. And this city has lasted a billion years, and everything else has just, you know, turned to dust, you know, and sand and desert and things like that. And the city works, keeps going, because it continuously refreshes itself and rebuilds itself to the design, which is held by the central computer in its memory banks. And I think it's got triple redundant memory banks, so at any one time, if anything happens, maybe a cosmic ray goes through one of the memory banks and changes anything like that, they're constantly checking all of the memory banks against the other two memory banks to say, hey, is it meant to be like this or is it meant to be like that? And, you know, the two override the minority report of the third, and then you have this is what's called the central computer, and it's got the eternity circuits, and then everything in the city is actually built from the atomic level or molecular level up. And so everything can be created from scratch and things like that. So all of the buildings in the city are just kept new all of the time. There's a representation of them in real life, which is, you know, in the city itself. And then there's another three representations of them in the virtual world in the central computer. And with the eternity circuits and with all that kind of stuff, the city is kept fresh and new. And it's like I say, it's under a dome, and there's skyscrapers around the edge, and then a park in the center of the city. Millions of people live there, and all of these people have a sort of immortality through reincarnation. What happens is that everybody they wake up and they live 1,000 years. And then at the end of the 1,000 years, they edit their memories down to what they want to remember in the future. And then they go back into the Hall of Creation, I think it's called. And then they're broken down and they're stored again into this, you know, memory units in the central computer. And then at a random time in the later, maybe a million years or another 20,000 years later, they are brought out of the memory banks again and recreated into the real world. And they live for a while, and then, you know, and they remember they remember their previous lives, or what they want to remember about their previous lives, which means that there's a continual churning of people within the city. So everybody isn't just hanging around in the city all the same, you know, say if there's 5 million people in the city, it's not the same 5 million people all the time. It means that no matter how many billion years into the future you're going to go, the chances of the same population living at any one time is very, very slim, because everyone's going in and out of memory and everyone's, you know, remembering different things, and there's always a different setup. There's always a different way, you know, or a different configuration of the people within the city. So we have this sort of utopian kind of thing going on here. However, it's very stagnant, or it's sort of stagnated. Everyone, the culture is pretty much just like people make art, and then if the art is good, people vote in it and say, hey, this art is good, let's leave it around a bit, you know, and let's store this in the memory banks. And people sort of try and find meaning by trying to please other people by art. And there's lots of other stuff going on. People, you know, they go on these virtual reality adventures, you know, and they do all these different kind of things, but generally just people hang out. Now, slowly we begin to realize that there's no night or day. It's always just day, you know, and nobody ever sleeps. There's no reason to sleep at all. And so it's a very, very unnatural, very, very conservative. In fact, it is the definition of conservative, because people can't change. Nobody wants to leave the city. In fact, it's sort of programmed into them by, you know, the members, by the central computer. When anyone is created, they don't want to leave the city, and there's no reason for them to leave the city, because outside of the city is nothing. They've been driven from the stars, the invaders are in the galaxy, and they're not allowed to leave the planet, and nothing outside of the city is worth going. So that's sort of like the basic setup for the story here, except we get, of course, we get this one guy called Alvin, and he is different from everyone else, because he isn't just interested in Diaspar. He sort of is not very content with just living in the city, and he wants to get out of the city. So the story goes a bit like this. The first third of the book recounts his journey as he discovers why he is unique, why he has these unique characteristics. I'm not going to spoil it now, because I think this is quite an interesting part of the story. And he works out, you know, he learns how the city works. I've just gone over sort of like a few little bits and pieces there as well. He meets lots of different people, talks with his tutor and all these other people, and he finds out what he must do to escape the city. And he escapes the city. Now, the second third of the book recounts his journey outside of the city on Earth, and he visits another civilization called Lys, which is sort of like the opposite in Diaspar in most ways as well. I'm not going to give too much away there. But then the last third of the story, he finds this spaceship and then takes a trip around the Milky Way, which is sort of like the stars aspect of the city and the stars kind of part of the title. Anyway, like I said before, I've read this book before, and for some reason, all I remembered about it was the first part and some of the second part. So maybe the first half, let's say that part as well. So, you know, Alvin exploring the city and interacting with the people, you know, and all that kind of stuff is interesting. You know, all the technology is explained and things like that. It's really interesting. It's really good science fiction, sort of utopian slash dystopian, you know, a billion years in the future. What will become of man? You know, what's it like to live in a utopia? Can change happen in a utopia? You know, is a utopia some kind of, again, to bring it back to this sort of like very centralized, controlling kind of thing, and everybody has to be programmed to be happy in the utopia, otherwise it can't be a utopia. If you're allowed outside of a utopia, it can't be a utopia. So there's all other kind of stuff going on there, the dystopia, utopia stuff going on, which I really liked. Really good science fiction. Then I couldn't remember, you know, and also, sorry, I remember when he goes to Lys as well, because it's like a contrast to Diaspar, because it's a different kind of utopia. It's a good contrast there. But then it just gets silly. Like, I like big, dumb object fiction, but the big, dumb object in this case seems to be the entire galaxy. And it's just too easy for Alvin to sort of explore where he wants. And, you know, there seems to be no effort on Alvin's part or danger on Alvin's part. You know, there's some close calls, but really it's not there. And then at the end, I found it really disappointing. It turns out that the history as presented by, you know, Diaspar computer and what everyone thinks is the real history of Diaspar and the world and the galaxy, turns out it's not true. There's like this billion year history, which, you know, that they think is true in Diaspar, and it's not based on reality. Instead, it's all fiction. And again, this is that could have been interesting, but you know, does Alvin work this out? You know, from the clues that he finds on in Diaspar or anything like that? No, nothing. There's nothing in Diaspar. You know, because Diaspar is completely artificial. There's no clues to find out what's going on. That reality isn't what he thought. And it's like, well, does he go and find out the true history? You know, from outside? No, he doesn't do that. He says, did he find out the true history, sort of, and then reveal it to others? No. What happens is that he discovers a god, brings it home, and then a few chapters before the end of the book, he turns the god over to the experts, and then they ask the god, like, what's going on here? And then the experts get everyone together and then tell them about it. So that's it. So everything, you know, and then you find out that all of the history is a lie. But the thing is, the lie that they were told is no more or less interesting than the truth, and the truth is no more or less interesting than the lie itself. I mean, both are, you know, I could say, okay, maybe the truth is slightly more interesting, but it's not satisfying because we're just told it within the story. So someone literally just gets up and says, this is the new history that we're all going to believe in now. And I'm just like, okay, so we're all just going to believe it now because this god that we met said that it's true, that, and his history that he said is more true than the history. So it is a real weird thing. It's very unsatisfying. And it's been, like I say, it's been a week and a half, or no, maybe 2 weeks since I've finished the book now. And I can't remember what the true story is that they were told at the end of it. I remember the official lie from, you know, that the people in Lys and Diaspar believed. And the reason I can remember the lie is because that actually affected people's lives. You know, Alvin was living in that world where that lie was the reality, in, you know, in a kind of weird sort of 1984 kind of way, that it doesn't matter what the truth is because the entire world is set up in reaction to what is actually a lie, and everyone in Diaspar and Lys believes that lie and stuff like that. But then the truth that we're told, I don't remember that, because how can I remember it? Because it didn't affect their lives in any way. I was told it was going to affect their lives, that now they knew the truth, that the world was going to change direction and that we're going to go and do this other kind of stuff. But being told that something is going to affect somebody's life means that I don't know how it's going to affect their life, and it's really difficult to care about it, you know. Their story hasn't changed course yet, if they haven't yet started, you know, if the thing hasn't started affecting their life yet. And we're told it will, but we don't see it, so I can't find it meaningful. Or maybe if I'm meant to find it meaningful, it means I just can't remember it. So, yeah, it's a bit strange that history was a lie is interesting, but the actual truth behind the history itself, not interesting at all. Really not interesting at all. In the same way, I mean, it reminds me of the book that I listened to, the Brandon Sanderson one, the Mistborn book as well. We find out that the history that we're being told there as well is a bit of a lie, but then it actually does affect people's lives. You know, we realise, oh, right, now, okay, now that does, and then they use that knowledge to actually change stuff at the end of the book. But here, we're told that everything is a lie, and then the story stops before they can use that stuff to change everything. So it's meaningless. That history is a lie is meaningless. And I'm sorry if I've spoiled that for anyone, but, you know, you should have read this book already if you're a science fiction fan. Let me look here. Where's my notes? Oh, yeah. So I think the key to only remembering the first part of the book since the last time I read it, you know, is that, you know, Alvin's story is completed once he leaves the city. You know, after that, we learn more about the history of the world, but nothing more about Alvin. And we learn more about the history of the galaxy, but Alvin doesn't change after that point as well. You know, when the book is an intimate look at Alvin, you know, I care about it. I care about the book. I care about Diaspar. I care about the story. I care about what Alvin is doing. And then when the story expands and it goes, okay, it's not just about Alvin now, it's about the city. Oh no, it's not just about the city, it's now about the world. Oh no, it's not just about the world, it's about the Milky Way. Oh no, it's not just about the galaxy, it's about the universe itself. Oh, it's not just about the universe, it's about all of time. It's about the end of the universe and what's going to happen. And once it goes that big, I'm just like, I can't care about it now. And that's probably why I forgot all of that part, you know, because maybe Alvin doesn't care. You know, he seems to be driven by this pre-programmed urge he can't explain, which is cool, but it doesn't mean what he finds out is interesting. Like, him being driven to find something out is interesting, but what he finds out isn't interesting. You know, and sometimes he'll land on a planet, you know, once he's flying around the galaxy, and he's obviously not that interested in exploration, you know. Like you say, he just wants answers, but he doesn't like exploring, which means that there isn't any of the kind of wonder that you get in, say, you know, Rama, but, you know, these other books by Arthur C. Clarke, where people are actually going, well, what is this thing? We need to find out. We need to look at a corridor. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to rest until we've locked down every corridor here as well, which is that kind of thing that you get in Rama. But here he goes, oh, well, we're obviously not going to find anything else in this solar system. Let's go elsewhere. And then he goes, oh, we pretty much found everything we're going to find. Let's go home now, you know. It's like Clarke wasn't even trying to write any kind of motivation at that point as well. It brings me on to some characters here. His Alvin character is pretty well developed up, like I say, up until that point in the story when he starts leaving, well, about, like I say, halfway through the book, I guess. And then that's, you know, it's interesting up to a point, because I really like the other characters' reactions to him. You know, he's got his girlfriend, his father, his mother, you know, his tutor, and also the Joker or Jester. Is it Jester or Joker? The character... who is there to sort of upset things in the city there, upset the things in diaspora as well, like that. And there's a real sense of ancientness about everything in the city, and about their, you know, their mindset is, you know, is very set. And I really like the way that, you know, they respond, because let me put it this way, they're given something to respond to in Alvin, and Alvin, you know, is responding to them and the city, so he actually gets some growth there. But then we go out into the rest of the world, and in Lys, no character has any depth at all there, you know, and we're told that Alvin makes good friends with someone else, but there's only one character interaction that stands out in all of his dealings with this other person, because nothing else is personal. It's all like, oh, I've got to find out the answers to the life, the universe, and everything, come with me on this journey. And this other guy goes, yeah, and then they make friends. And at one point, you know, they there's this little comment, it goes, oh, you know, and then I can't remember the guy's name, Haviland or something like that. Anyway, this friend that he makes as well, he goes, wait a second, Alvin, you've not got a belly button. And Alvin goes, aha. And then it just says, and then over the, it took a few hours, you know, a day later, it took Alvin a few hours to explain why he doesn't have a belly button. Of course, it's because he's created from scratch by the computer. And that was a really nice little character moment, but he didn't actually say what the character moment was. He just, you know, he just said that character moment happened, but yet we only hear about it secondhand through the narrator. We don't actually see it played out, and it's really strange. It's like those character moments are what's important. If you want us to care about the characters, you've got to show them as characters interacting, and we get some of that at the beginning of the book. You know, like when Alvin is right at the beginning of the book, he's going in this virtual reality tour with his friends, and is, you know, and he goes, well, let's just go and have a look over there, and they go, well, that's not part of the virtual reality system here. We don't need to go over there. He's like, no, let's go and look, and then they're like, Alvin, what are you doing that for? You're spoiling it for everyone. Just, why don't we just play out the virtual reality? Why do you always have to go and look and see what's over the horizon? He's like, well, I don't want to. Like, that kind of character moment teaches me about Alvin and makes me care about him and really tells me about his, you know, his situation and things like that. But later on in the book, it's just like, Alvin is very different from everyone else, and these people are very different from Alvin. It's just like, don't tell me, show me him interacting, show me those character moments. Like, you know, you get some, it gets later on in the book, and like the non-talking, totally silent robot seems to have a stronger character than the actual characters, like the human characters in the book. It's very strange, which I'll get into later as well. And then, like I say, right at the end of the book, well, it reminded me of, if you've seen the latest version of King Kong by Peter Jackson, who gets the last lines of the movie? It's just two, you know, newspaper photographers. They just go then, you know, King Kong has died, just fell off the top of the Empire State Building, laying down there on the ground. And they come up to it and they take a photo of him and they get the last lines. It's like, oh, what was all the fuss about? Oh, no, he's just some big dumb ape or something like that. It's like, well, it's a nice line just to say, well, he's just a big dumb ape or a stupid dumb ape or whatever the line is. But I'm just like, who are these guys? Who gave the final line of the movie to two characters who have not said anything? We've not seen them at all throughout the entire movie until they get the last line of the movie, you know. And that's what we get here in this book. You know, the person who gets to reveal the real story of the galaxy to the rest of the remaining population of the humans in the entire galaxy. It's sort of like a big story that he's telling. Who gets to tell that story? Is it Alvin? No. Is it Alvin's tutor that we know about? No. Is it anybody you look at? No. It's just some random guy. It's just like, oh yes, I am the leader of the historians. And he goes, now this is the new history that we're going to believe. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Anyway, so that was a bit disappointing as well. So, you know, Alvin throughout the story gets less and less of a role until he's pretty much irrelevant by the end of the thing. Excuse me, I'm going to have a drink here. My voice is going. So, moving on to some... Oh yeah, technology here as well. I talked about the central computer a bit and the virtual reality thing. I quite like the depictions of virtual reality here as well. And I really like the depictions. I mean, I don't know if this is some of the first depictions. 1956 is early for this kind of stuff, but sort of like the post-humanism, and also not just the post-humanism, but like the post-reality kind of factor of Diaspar as a city. It very is sort of like very much it feels like a post-singularity kind of thing as well, in some ways. But what I really like is like the blurring of reality and fiction, and people, you know, at one point the two characters meet and Alvin just presumes that the person he's met is a real person, and it is a real person, but he presumes he's meeting him in reality, and suddenly he just disappears and winks out of existence because he was just a projection, you know, just using a, you know, some kind of holographic projection to project himself there into that part of the city where Alvin always does. And he goes, oh, well, that's bad etiquette. You're not meant to do that. If you're just a projection, you're meant to, you know, indicate that you're a projection in some way before, you know, so people think, you know, so people know that you're a projection rather than they're in person and meeting them in person. And lots of people never meet other people in person. They can, like, live it out 1,000 years without ever meeting people in person, only ever doing stuff via projection or meeting in virtual reality worlds and things like that. And I really like those kind of exploration of those ideas. And I'm sure it might have been done before, but I, you know, when you think this book was actually originally written in the 1940s, and then was rewritten, like it said here, it used to be the what is it, the Against the Fall of Night was written in 1948, and then this book was sort of a rewrite of that book in 1956. So I'm not quite sure how far back these ideas goes, but it really is interesting to see these early sort of like post-physical kind of ideas being explored here as well. And the Eternity circuits are pretty good as well. I explained about them before. And I, like I said, I'll just go into a little bit of a critique here, or a little bit of a thing here. So... the tech in Diaspar I really liked. It's really good science fiction, and also in Lys, because, you know, this the opposite human place on Earth as well. You know, it showed sort of like a balanced or more nuanced use of the same technology there as well. I don't want to get too into it. Read the book if you want to find out more as well. And we find out, of course, that this has lasted 1 billion years, and it's a long time. And the city lasting 1 billion years, you're like, okay, this is a big machine. It's a city-sized machine, and it constantly replenishes itself and replicates itself and keeps going and keeps going and keeps going like that. 1 billion years is a long time. You're like, wow, there's a lot that's gone into this. And then we discover something else has survived 1 billion years, like a robot, and then a spaceship, and then things on other planets, and then a star with other, you know, 7 other stars orbiting it. And suddenly what was viewed as like this pinnacle of science and technology, which was the city itself, we find out is just one of many other things that have lasted 1 billion years. And suddenly something lasting 1 billion years isn't special anymore. It's just commonplace. And I know that Clark was going for a sense of wonder by the end of the book, I'm sure, but he misses really, really badly in this case for me as well. Like that, at the beginning of the book, I did have a sense of wonder in Diaspar. And that's because a sense of wonder comes from me knowing that something has meaning. Well, if not meaning, that it has a sense of history, or a sense of purpose, or it has a sense of scale, or it has a sense of reality, it has a sense of technology there as well. And I made a note here that recently, one of the reasons why I didn't do a review of this book is that I got a bit distracted by playing a computer game. And this computer game is called Minecraft. And maybe you've heard about Minecraft. It's quite a popular game at the moment, and it looks terrible. I mean, it looks like, you know, it's a 3D game where it's like a world creation game and a zombie kind of survival game at the same time. And it looks like, you know, compared to other computer games, the technology behind it is really, really limited. Or, you know, it's like the presentation, the graphics, all these blocky stuff. People look like Lego men as well. It's definitely got a Lego kind of feel. Because the idea is that you actually mine rock and cut down trees, and then you take these blocks and build with them. And I, in this server that I going on as well, I've built some, you know, awesome towers and some walkways over the clouds, and I've dug deep, as deep as possible, hollowed out some caverns and stuff like that. But other people on the server have built way bigger and more impressive, you know, structures and tunnels and mines and dug better mines and stuff, and they've got some real aesthetic qualities. And I have a sense of wonder when I look at these things, and it's not because they look big or that they look good, but it's because I know that for every virtual block that was, you know, has been built, you know, every block that I see in one of these buildings has been virtually mined from the ground and then virtually smelted, and then a player has virtually set one on top of another, and the tools that were needed to do this were created from scratch by each player. Like, if you want to have an iron pickaxe to mine more easily, you've got to mine until you find both iron ore and then coal to smelt the iron ore, and then you've got to smelt it, and then you've got to build and craft the tools that you're going to use. And every structure takes work. But the structure itself is in a virtual world. In the same way, this is what I wanted to talk about in the technology. You actually get something a bit like this with the central computer. At one point, Alvin goes down and has a look at a virtual representation of the world, and he looks around. And you know, when you read this kind of thing, you think, well, that's, you know, Google Earth. That's a computer game. But back in 1956, that's actually quite impressive. I was talking to someone last Friday, actually, at a meetup about this, and we were talking about this book, and he was saying, yeah, this, you know, the computer representation of the city that he was looking at. When I read that 20 years ago or 30 years ago when I first read this book, this guy was saying, yeah, it's an amazing thing, and it's, you know, and he says that now, you know, I look at any computer game or Google Earth and it's right there, and I think, yeah, it's pretty impressive. Now, in a lot of computer games, I don't have a sense of wonder when looking at them. I do sometimes as well. You know, the buildings in other computer games, they look way better than they do in Minecraft. And even they look way better than they do in Google Earth or anything like that. They've got way more detail and they're properly designed and they've got unique elements and things like that. But there's a reason I don't have the same sense of wonder. It's because they're made by people in a studio. And if they want to make a building taller, they just click and drag with a mouse, or they type in a higher number or something like that. Now, in Minecraft, if you want a taller building, you've got to spend more time digging. So every structure in Minecraft takes work, but it's a virtual building, but it doesn't take virtual work to do it. It takes real work to be able to build it, and that kind of stuff. And in the same way that, you know, Google Earth, when you go and have a look at, you know, go onto Google Earth, download Google Earth, go and look at Manhattan, go and look at New York in Google Earth. Every building has been recreated. And it's not just sort of like, go, okay, we're going to create a virtual world in a computer. No, they've had to go in and they've actually had to build each one of these buildings by hand. It's done by Google. So maybe they've got some ways to do it all computationally and things like that. It's the same with Berlin. I can go and look at my house as recreated by Google Earth, and I can actually look at my front door, and I can look at my backyard, and I can stand in my backyard and look around. And I mean, I can go and do it, you know, virtually, or I can go and do it in reality now as well. But I get a sense of wonder even when I do it virtually, because I know that someone's put in a fuck ton of time. This hasn't been created just from scratch in computer. They've actually had to send up a satellite there to take photos of my backyard to do it. They've had to drive down every single street in Berlin for me to have a look at, you know, to have a look at the front of my house in Street View, which you can now do here in Blermany, or Germany, as you know it's called. And so like you say, it takes real work, and that's where you get the sense of wonder. To bring this back to fiction, Diaspar, the city, has this rigorously worked out history. It has a reason to exist. It has a real people in it. It has like a developed, like highly developed culture. They've got artistic styles that they talk about there, which is a reaction to the culture. And it's got, like, you know, the conservative stuff as well, going like the conservative culture that they have. It's got this architectural style, which is based on certain principles. It's got robots looking after it. It's got this political system controlling it. It's got the central computer. It's got a transport system with these walkways that people jump on and off the walkways and take lifts and all these different kind of things there. You know, the people who live in it are built, you know, they really do live in it. And, you know, when they go to the edge of it, they're afraid to look outside, and Alvin is working around this kind of stuff. Clark put a lot of legwork into this city. It shows the details. Even the character of the Joker or Jester, I can't remember exactly his name now as well, it makes sense that there is a character like that. Everything is there, and it's built from the ground up. And it, like I say, it's taken work to do that, and I get a sense of wonder with Diaspar. It's really interesting science fiction. By the end of the book, we've got this galaxy spinning shit, you know, it's just too easy when you do that kind of, like, when you just say, oh, we created a mind of pure intellect. You haven't spent time mining the mind of pure intellect out of virtual rock. I mean, you haven't spent time underground digging it out and going, fuck, I don't want more of this redstone. I want, you know, iron ore. I want coal and stuff like that. And when you just say at the end of the book, they departed the galaxy to face a more powerful force at the end of time. So you haven't searched for the iron ore and the coal and smelted it and then made made the stick and put the haft onto the thing and then gone out there and dug more and stuff like that. You've got to put in the work. You've got to put in the vigorous work in behind this. And you get that in Diaspora. And that gives me a sense of wonder. If you just say, blah, 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 you know, mind, galaxy-spanning mind, blah, 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 energies beyond our comprehension, blah, 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 that whole sense of wonder just disappears. I just have no interest anymore. Like Peter F. Hamilton made a note here as well. He does this quite a lot. You know, he sort of throws around the God stuff and the wonder stuff as well. But then, it's, you know, my favourite battle of the sort of the dream of the Dreaming Void and the Void trilogy itself isn't sort of like the world-smashing, you know, battles that happen throughout the rest of the book. It's like in the Dreaming Void, there's this one guy, I think it's Adam, the guy who can't remember his own name or where his, or his own history. He breaks into this clinic and has this battle, and it's described and sort of like millisecond by millisecond. Literally, it's like he sees the bullets coming towards him, you know, he sees all this kind of stuff, and when he gets hit by something, it describes at an almost cellular level, no, like a subcellular level, like a molecular level, what is going on inside his body as a bullet rips through him. Like I'm saying, he's done the Minecraft on the novel, on this idea. He really goes into the details and things like that. And thankfully, Peter F. Hamilton, when he does go into sort of like the mind-blowing sense of wonder, God does it, all that kind of stuff, sure, it's a little bit less satisfying, but at least he's written a basis for this kind of thing to exist. Now, in The City in the Stars, we get the city, which is really, really well described and really enjoyable to read about. And then we get the stars, and then it just all falls flat for me anyway. So let's see if I can finish up here in the next 10 minutes. See if I can get this. Oh yeah, the themes of this novel as well. There's all kinds of themes in this book. It varies, you know, he's going for lots of philosophy and stuff like that. You know, one appears like, say, this history or authority that, you know, we're capable of believing things. You know, what's presented as a past that affects us more than the real truth and stuff like that, which is strange, you know. It's a bit about religion and stuff like that, but one second, I'll just take another quick drink. My voice is hurting me here. Forgetting most of the themes in this book, which, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. One thing that really stood out to me is, like I say, before reading this, I listened to the Space Dogs podcast, and when this book was brought up, it was actually brought up in this roundtable discussion by Asimov, and I can't remember the other authors who were in this roundtable discussion about it. Listen to it. It's worth listening to. Just check out the Space Dogs podcast. Yeah, that was another email with someone who was asking me if I'd read the Courtney Brown... Oh, no, listen to the Courtney Brown podcast. Yes, I have. That's the reason why I've read quite a few books again or for the first time, because he talked about them there. Space Dogs podcast. There's my other... My new recommendation, except the most recent episode, which you can't listen to because it's Robert Silverberg recording. The quality of the recording is really, really bad. Anyway, let me get back onto this. So, in the Space Dogs podcast, let me actually say what I want to say now. Isaac Asimov, these are the Golden Age science fiction authors. One of them asked the book. He goes, I think it's actually Asimov. He says, what's Clark's book? You know, the one there's this robot in a city and he's trying to find his way outside. And someone else goes, oh yeah, The City in the Stars. He goes, that's the one. And that got me thinking. I was like, wait a second. Alvin is a robot trying to find his way outside the city? And then I was like, yeah. And then I was like, after reading the book, I was like, yeah, of course. By almost every definition that you can have, you've got to say, yes, Alvin and everybody else in Diaspora is a robot. And that never really occurred to me the previous times I've read the book. I mean, he's created from scratch by a computer. He has no belly button. He has no hair or fingernails. He has no teeth. His body is created to last 1,000 years. He can't get diseases. You know, he can't injure himself, or if he does injure himself, it's there like that. So he can program his own memories. He can delete his memories at will, which is a bit weird as well. He knows he won't die, and instead he's going to be disassembled by the computer and stored in a memory bank. More importantly, you know, he's created to, like Alvin himself, he discovers that, and other people in the story as well, like the Jester and stuff, they know that they're created to fulfill a function as set by the city, as set by the computer. And he's also programmed to do his job. You know, he has a limited sense of free will, or no free will, or in some ways he's got free will as well. He follows the urges and set, you know, as set by the central computer. And And it's not just Alvin, but other characters as well are reprogrammed by the city. At one point, actually, we see the city reprogramming a real robot. It overwhelms the robot's senses, you know, using this false perception, and hacks into the robot's mind to change its perception of reality, and in that way changes the programming of the robot, which otherwise isn't under its control. And later on, we see exactly the same process being carried out on a human from Diaspora as well. The central computer overwhelms the human with false perception, and in that way changes his attitudes or changes his programming and stuff like that. And it's not just the central computer that can reprogram humans. There's other factors as well. I don't want to go into it and spoil it as well. But then, like, in all of this, I understand, you know, why Asimov says, oh yeah, it's a story of a robot trying to leave a city. Alvin is a robot. And yet Clark never sort of winks at us with that. You know, he drops hints all the time, like the whole, you know, not having any teeth. It's just like a throwaway line, not having a belly button. It's like, yeah, of course. But, you know, how much they're, you know, the people of Diaspora know that they're created. They know that they're sort of artificial, but they just presume that they're still entirely human. And they never ever think, oh, I'm a robot. They never look at the other robots and goes, oh yes, I'm just another function of the city. Even though, like I say, exactly the same processes that are carried out on the robot are carried out on the humans. And in the same way that the robots are programmed to do stuff, the humans are programmed to do stuff. Their memories are programmed, their motivations are programmed, their characters are programmed, and they're all happy with that and stuff like that. And it really made me think a lot about the line between robot and human. And I know it's been done, you know, that whole line is, you know, that line and that idea has been explored loads in science fiction. But then I was thinking, well, of course, it's no surprise that Asimov picked up, you know, he took one look at Alvin and goes, yeah, robot, because he wrote The Bicentennial Man and all the other, you know, robots. That was his thing, you know. But I really like the subtler exploration of this theme and this idea. Like in so many books, we sort of go, oh, this is a robot. Oh, the robot wants to be human. Oh, like that. And, you know, oh, robots, human, humans, robots, and stuff like that. But here, the robots are so human that they just presume they're human. And so do the readers, or so did I, like the first once, or I can't remember how many times I've read this book, but certainly the first up until this time, I never really looked at Alvin. I thought, yeah, superhuman, you know, post-human humanity. But then I was like, no, he's just a robot. Yeah. So again, I'm not going to say what makes a robot or what makes a human, because for me to do that, I'd pretty much have to write, you know, as much science fiction as Isaac Asimov did. there's different ways to look at it. Like I say, this is just a little bit of a subtle thing. I made a note here. The writing style and stuff. I talked a bit about the characterization. The writing is okay, you know, and stuff like that. What I want to talk a bit more about here is actually the narration and the audio production. It was narrated by Jeffrey T. Williams, according to audible.com, it says here. Yeah. And he's a very good narrator. However, we also have a full cast of audio, a full cast audio kind of thing going on here. So every time a character speaks, we switch to an actor who says their lines for them as well. It's like, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, 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 he said. And then he went over here. He exclaimed in surprise, oh, blah, 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 blah. So the thing is, I don't really like that kind of stuff. It's just not my kind of thing. Every time that someone spoke, every time the narrator didn't say something and an actor said something instead, it just took me out of the story. It took me out, you know, especially when it had been a while, like the character had been doing something, exploring and stuff. And then, like, as he was doing it, he was thinking stuff. And I had, like, this different idea of their voice in my mind. And then the narrator shuts up and then an actor comes in. And I've noticed actually before, it's like, even when the narrator is saying a character's voice, I actually, even if they're putting on a different voice or putting on a different accent, I never really imagine the character as speaking like that. You know, what I mentioned this before when I reviewed House of Suns, and even though all the characters are all clones of themselves, they all have different accents. Like, this one's got a Scottish accent, this one's got a Brummie accent, this one's got a, you know, Scouse accent, and all these different kind of things. But I never really thought that those were the accents that they were actually using. I just presumed, you know, I just had, it was just a way to distinguish the different characters in a conversation. And yet somehow, because it was just the narrator saying what they were saying, I had a weird disconnect that I just presumed. And actually, I'm going to talk about this in the next review that I do, which is Joe Abercrombie's The Blade itself, which I've already finished and I'll get to reviewing over the next day or so. And in that as well, loads of different accents all the time. But I never think, oh yes, someone from this country has a West Country accent, or someone from over here has, you know, like a northern kind of Manchester, or, you know, Lancastrian accent, or this someone over here has a Cockney accent. I never really thought that the main character had a Cockney accent, even though everything he said was in a Cockney accent, because it was just, you know, it was just a conceit by the narrator. But when two characters are talking, and there's this one kid, Alvin, has an American accent, like a young American accent, and then he goes over and talks to Hilvar, that's his name. So he goes over and talks to Hilvar, and Hilvar also has an American accent, and then they go and talk to someone else and he has an American accent. I actually think, you know, it's being presented, this is how this person speaks. So even, it doesn't matter that quite a lot of the actors don't, you know, they're not very good actors, and quite a lot of the voices don't really fit what they should be in my head. I'm just saying that the fact that it's a full cast kind of audio production. I know actually Full Cast Audio is actually a production house. I don't know if they did it, but there is a full cast here. So yeah, it's just very distracting, just really not the kind of thing that I like. It really did take me out of the story. Maybe some people prefer that kind of thing, but for me, I really do just prefer the narrator. And Jeffrey T. Williams, actually, really good narrator. I really enjoyed what he did with it. What I did like, though, is that there was some sound effects. No, actually, I didn't like the sound effects. What I did like was the ambient noises, not the single sound effects where he's like, the door slammed, clunk. I don't really like that. But I like the low rumbling sound when they're under the city. And then when they climb a mountain, there's like wind going like that. And then when they go into a, you know, into the central computer, there's this like, not music, but like this humming and electronic kind of sounds going on in the background, which really did put you in the mood, or put me in the mood as well for this, because I really dislike music behind narration, mainly because, you know, when I'm walking around and listening to podcasts, I often have, or, you know, podcasts or audiobooks, I enjoy that I get the ambient noise as well. So if there's music playing, that's also going on in the background, and if other things are going on, I like that. But so I don't like music behind speech, but actually just this very low level sort of ambient sound, really enjoyed that there as well. So that's all I've got to say about the book. I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars. The start is really good. The science fiction element of the book is really good. The fantastical stuff at the end really, really didn't grab me this time. And yeah, the city is interesting. The stars are not interesting. Alvin within the city is interesting. Alvin outside of the city is not interesting. You know, when it expands, the story really, really suffers. The characters really, really suffers. The setting really, really suffers. The science fictional elements really, really suffer. Pretty much everything goes downhill after about, you know, 45% of the way through this book. So if you're going to read it, I say read up until the point where... Oh, I don't know. Yeah, up until the point where... No, I can't. I don't want to say the point where you should stop reading, because that's when. Read up until the point where Alvin flies away for the first time, because that is, or maybe no, a bit after that. I can't remember. And again, I don't want to spoil the exact moment where. But the thing is, where that happens, that's for me the natural ending of the book. Where the thing that I don't want to spoil happens is the natural, and it's about halfway through the book, or maybe just over halfway through the book. So read up until there as well. Like, and then again, I was just thinking now. I just made a note of this. In 10 years' time, I'm gonna have forgotten the second half of this book, and I'll wonder why I only gave this book 2.5 stars. And I'll be like, no, surely this is a 4-star book. It really, or 4.5 star, because it's a classic, it's a masterwork, it's one of the great science. It really isn't. And let me just have a look here on Goodreads.com. I've got a feeling here as well. Yeah, reviewed by 7 friends. 4.1 average here as well. Manau 2 rated at 4 stars. Carl 4 stars. Russ Olsen 4 star, no, 3 stars. Per Eric 4 stars. Sean O'Hara 5 stars. Ove 5 stars. Yeah, so there's lots of 4 and 5 star reviews here. But really, guys, when did you read this book? Did you read it 10 years ago? You've forgotten the second half, which is shit. All you remember is the really cool stuff at the beginning. So 2.5 stars for this. And that's it. So thanks a lot for all the feedback. I will get around to replying to the emails that people sent me, and I really do reply to every email that I get. even if it takes me a week or two, I do get back to it. And I really enjoy some of the, well, pretty much enjoy every single email correspondence and conversation and debate that I have via email as well. The other thing you can do is, like I say, get onto goodreads.com. I've now got, how many friends have I got now on goodreads.com? I can't see now. But yeah, I've got lots of friends on there, and I really like that because I enjoy seeing what people are reading and keeping up with other people's reading as well as you keeping up with mine through this as well. I put up updates as well all the time as I'm reading a book. I put like, yep, I'm at 30% of the way through, and I'll put a little comment and things too. And you can also send me messages or comment on my reviews there as well. Otherwise, sfbip.com, there's a list of every single episode I've put out so far, sorted by episode number, by rating, and by author, which is handy if you're looking for, if you just want to get the books that I gave good reviews to, or you just want to hear me rant about different things as well. And the other thing that you can do is go to iTunes and put a review on iTunes if you want. As I've got some 1-star reviews recently, or let me put it this way, in the past year since the last time I checked on iTunes, my reviews on iTunes, I've got some 1-star reviews, which I might go into a little bit next week because they're relevant to the fantasy book that I'm going to be reviewing next time. I say next week, next episode. It's The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie. It's a fantasy book. I'll talk about that. Also, coming up in the future, I will try and find Eiffelheim, because people are saying, oh yeah, I'm looking forward to your Eiffelheim review, which is a book I started in January last year, and it took me, you know, because it was just one of those books that I kept picking up and putting down and picking up and putting down. And I was, just before I set off in December for my last work trip, I was like, oh, I really want to finish this. If I can finish this up in the next 3 days, I'll be able to review it as soon as I, you know, when I leave. And I never managed to do it. I was like within just 90 pages of the end, or 100 pages of the end of the book, and I didn't manage to review it. And I've come home 2 months later, I can't find the book anywhere. I must have put it down, because I remember it was literally, I was reading it because I'd got up a bit early, and I was reading it and then put it down, walked out the door and got my, you know, walked out the door on the way to the airport. So I had a subletter in over the winter, over Christmas, and they must have moved it somewhere, put it somewhere, or maybe just thought, oh, this is a good book, and taken it somewhere. So I can't find Eiffelheim. I've only got 100 pages to go. So I'm going to see if I can find it round at the secondhand bookshop. They might have another copy there, because that's where I got it from. So I'll go onto that. I managed to actually download Lord of Light. I said before, Roger Zelazny? Yeah, I think. And lots of people wanted me to review that. It's one of the most requested books. I downloaded it as an audiobook, but the files didn't work. I've downloaded it again, and now they're working, so I'm going to read that as well. And also for the science fiction and fantasy SFF audio podcast as well, we're going to read Len Dayton's SSGB, which won't come on here, but I'll plop that episode in the feed. We'll be recording that next Sunday as well, so I'm gonna that'll be in the feed as well for anyone who's interested. Anyway, I think that's about it. You can follow me on Twitter at Luke Burge on Twitter. Don't bother trying to become my Facebook friend. I'm not really interested in having SFBRP listeners on there, unless you know me already, unless you are actually a friend. I use Facebook to communicate with friends and family and jugglers, but I use this podcast and Twitter and my blog and sfbrp.com to communicate, and email more to communicate with listeners of the SFBRP. And that's not me saying that you're not my friends. Like, I would rather talk to you guys and correspond with you guys by email, because that way I can sort of write long form and you can write long form. Email has a different thing. And if we're having scholarly discussions or intellectual discussions, email is by far the better way to have those discussions rather than on Facebook. So I'm, you know, not slighting you guys by saying don't bother becoming my friend on Facebook. There's nothing there for you. It's all in the podcast and all by email and on goodreads.com and slightly on Twitter, although I'm doing less and less with Twitter at the moment. You know, I still read it, but I just, for some reason, I'm just not posting so much there. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening to me waffle on about books and about life and about all this kind of stuff, and I hope you're enjoying it, and I'll catch you next time.